Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 30th, 2018, and welcome to episode 179 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever
ERCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and International Podcast Day. So welcome to International Podcast Day, which we are going to take to mean that it is our day because we are an international podcast. So that's actually Carrington's joke. And joining me today is Carrington.
And my jokes.
As well as some other people, but I'll start with Carrington.
Hello, Paul.
How are you doing?
Excellent. So we are an international podcast, unlike those podcasts that can only be downloaded like locally.
That's right. Also, to continue on the international theme, from my perspective at least, is Michael Mulhern joining us from Australia. How are you?
I'm fine. Yeah, things are a bit quiet here on the retro front, mainly because the local rural fire service are wanting to do a 3.5-acre pile burn in my backyard.
I don't know what that means, but...
Well, hazard reduction, so you burn the bush before it burns you.
I see. Okay, so they're not bringing things into your property to burn.
No. They're just going to... They've just gone and cut their containment line where they'll start the fire, and then my neighbours and I and the Crown land that is adjacent to our properties will basically go up in smoke. It's a low-intensity burn, so it should be interesting. It's the first time I've had a large fire that's not a barbecue.
It's a little freaky.
We have Crown land here in Canada as well.
Yes.
And probably Earl Evans over in Portland does not have Crown land.
Doesn't
how are you doing
that? Oh, that's right. In the States, you call it up for grabs, don't you?
I don't know what they call it.
Well, there's BLM land in the West.
Yeah. Okay, I assume what you mean is basically it's like federal property, right?
Yeah, up for grabs.
Hi, Earl.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, we got the federal property out here. In terms of my own property, I don't have any kind of an estate. Like, Michael, I'm on a fairly small bunch of land here, and we don't like it when any of it burns. So we're going to try to keep the fires down. And actually, we got a little rain over the last couple of days, so that's good because it's been pretty dry, too. But I'm doing great. It's good to talk to you guys.
Property is theft. Seize the means of production. Wait, sorry.
What?
Carrington, that's your other podcast.
Okay. Anyway, so here we are, recording after a fairly long time, it seems. And despite all the time that has elapsed between recordings, we don't have a topic. So today's topic is going to be catching up on all the stuff that has happened since we last recorded and celebrating International Podcast Day, because maybe that's going to be our traditional International Podcast Day celebration technique, is to not have a host topic.
Indeed. Everyone tilt a glass.
Yes.
Hurrah.
A moment of silence during the host's topic. Anyway, but okay, so given that, I will just first dive into listener feedback then, now that we're done talking about the weather and controlled burns and that sort of thing.
Sounds like a book by Mark Pilgrim. Dive into listener feedback.
Yes, exactly.
Not one of his bigger sellers.
Right. Okay, so let's see. We actually had a couple of things. So Chris pointed out over email that the EEV blog, you know, video blog, did a two-part warehouse dive at the Australian Computer Museum site, which we talked about, and I think the last time we recorded. Michael, did you by any chance happen to see these?
I haven't looked at the videos, but I've, having been there firsthand and done a bit more than just opening up boxes and peering inside. As I think I might have said on one of the previous podcasts, I helped finish loading one of the last containers to go in, and then there was just some other stuff that was being taken out by truck, but. As far as I know, nothing retro was left behind.
Excellent. Yeah, so I think it was a little bit interesting. I didn't know of the existence of this before Chris had emailed us about it, these videos, but I have to say they're a little irritating because basically the guy, I assume if you've seen the video, and you know he has his way about him, but basically he just went in I don't know where everybody was. I mean, I kind of assume that he just basically kept people out of shot. But, he went in and kind of, like, opened a bunch of boxes and, like, you know, just left sort of, like, the things that people had organized, he left disorganized and moved on to other things. And it's sort of like, you know, what are you doing? You're not helping at all.
Yeah. He obviously didn't do the video while I was there because there wouldn't have been a part two. The rest of us were, I suppose, distracted by, you know, stacking stuff up on pallets and shifting it out and putting it into containers on the backs of trucks, other useful things.
Yeah. It was still kind of cool, at least, to see, you know, you got a chance to see some of the stuff that was there.
Yeah, it did highlight very well the state of how everything was. That was the thing that really got me, that there was just... racks of gear there. It was very dusty. And the back room where there was just boxes of manuals. You know, if you're after a deck manual or anything along those lines, documentation, that was the place to go. I'm so glad that that's all out. But now the hard, that was actually the easy part, is packing it up and getting it out. The hard part is getting things organized. So glad to say there's some new younger blood. I was about to say young blood, but there's definitely no young blood in my body. But yes, some younger blood in there with some ideas, and we're seeing what we can do as far as storage and also presentation space.
Excellent. Well, as soon as there's news, let us know. All right, let's see. So Rob wrote over email, continuing the cycle, to thank us for mentioning Omnivore, he said that version 2 will be specifically aimed at making it easier to make custom Jumpman levels, so we are all to encourage Jack to get going and start working on these Jumpman levels he has ideas about.
So when we said get going and he hasn't turned up, that wasn't the get going that we meant.
Yeah, right. Come back and then get going.
Sorry, Jack.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged by that Omnivore, you know, the rekindling of interest in Jumpman, because it's absolutely my favorite platformer of all time. And does it even count as a platformer because it's like a single screen and you don't really scroll? But it's just so much fun. I love that game. And, you know, that people are making new levels for it is incredibly cool.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned Omnivore last time, and he'd introduced a rewind feature, and that was apparently sort of in service of making it easier to test out your custom code for the Jumpman levels.
So, oh, beautiful.
So let's see. Brent sent an email about printers. You know, so we talked about collecting printers and you know, the possibility that maybe actually not enough people are collecting printers given the importance that they had. He wrote with actually a fairly extended message talking about how he's collected a few printers for the VIC-20. So there's a VIC-1525 and the ubiquitous MPS-801. This is I assume those in the VIC-20 world will recognize those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I recognize the numbers.
Yes, 8. I remember. I know there's an 8 there.
I don't use 0 an awful lot, but...
Well, it's so new. I'm still not convinced the 0 is going to stick around.
I like 3.
Well, the problem with 0 is that, like, you know, it's all the way around the dial, so it, like, hurts your finger if you had to dial a 0. I always want to avoid that.
Wait, you have telephones? This would be a retro thing. Poser.
Yep. But he was promoting the MPS 801 as a great early microcomputer printer to have, because it's sort of, you know, it has a history to it. It's manufactured by Seikosha and then Commodore badged, but it was also rebadged by other companies. So the Atari 1029 is I guess the same thing. And I think there are a number of printers that were like that, you know, that companies would somebody would manufacture, like C. Ito or whoever, however you pronounce that, would produce these printers that other people would badge.
I think Seikosha had a lot of OEMs also.
So, and the other thing that Brent mentioned in his email was about salvaging consumables, you know, so the issue of the printer ribbons and things that, you know, dry up and run out. And so it is possible if they dry up, it is possible to kind of like bring them back to life. Brent was suggesting WD-40 and said that he was a little worried about this possibly gunking up, but so far it's been okay. So if it's just dry but still has ink, then you can sort of revive it that way. And you can also re-ink them if you have stamp pad ink that you just sort of like put on the ribbon. And then if the ribbon wears out, it is possible to transplant a ribbon from something else into your cartridge. So if you keep a cartridge with a dried out or spent ribbon in it, you can often do a transplant fairly easily. And of course, it's going to be more easy to get the ribbon than the cartridge. So, you know, you don't want to throw the cartridge away. It all seems like a lot of trouble to me, but nevertheless.
I think that's why not many people do it. It's a lot of work, messy.
Yes, very, very. I can see that being, I don't want ink all over everything, but for definitely for a black ink printer ribbon, that would work pretty well. I think the ones that I would be sort of most interested in having are the color ImageWriter 2 ribbons, but those, I imagine those are probably, I mean, except for like reviving them with oil or whatever, but even that, you know, I think it'd be very hard to do anything with that and not just to turn it into a big, like, brown ribbon. Anyway, thanks for writing. That's, it's interesting to hear, like, that there's been some success with this printer ribbon re-inking. Ben posted to Facebook a link to someone's amusing photo of someone using a calculator-sized portable terminal with an acoustic coupler on a payphone, smoking a pipe. It's fantastic. I don't know, did you guys see this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like you do.
It is I think actually I saw somebody else refer to it as, like, the best stock photo that exists or something. But
It's right up there with the soldering iron.
Oh yes, right. holding it below the,
yes,
like,
yes,
the tip, like a,
yes,
pen.
Mm.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And also Ben also posted a link to I think on the Facebook page as well, to ThinkPad 701 restore using compact flash media. And I think essentially the gist of the link was that the attempt was to take a ThinkPad 701 and restore it to its like system original, like factory configuration, so with all the software that was installed in originally with it and that sort of thing, but with no CD drive. And so it's basically just sort of outlining, you know, how you can get from a like a PCM CIA slot CF adapter to bringing it back. I wasn't able to 100% follow what, you know, the process was, but in particular, I'm not quite sure what role a floppy disk plays in this. Maybe none, but maybe you're making a floppy. I'm not quite exactly sure, but at any rate, it was another link that was interesting. Also, it was interesting. It's interesting to note that I will say hello to Ben, who I know from, like, I know him professionally as well, so I thought that was kind of interesting. So, welcome to the overlap of worlds. Let's see. We've recently gotten some interesting notes from Beej over Twitter on a number of things. I mean, he's been pointing out sort of interesting facts about stuff that we've been mentioning. One of the things he mentioned was that Apple produced 45 different printer models between 1980 and 1999, and a plotter. I didn't know that. That sounds like a really high number. To me, but I guess if you consider all the like laser jets and things like that, or not laser jets, but whatever you call the Apple ones, laser writers,
laser writer, I think.
So that's cool. So thanks, Beej. So if you want to see all the other interesting things, you can also look at our mentions on Twitter. Yes. Okay. Continuing on the feedback. So Jason Scott has tweeted something. kill sprees. But
this time it's from jail.
No, actually. Yeah. So he specifically wanted to highlight the fact that if anyone has any big Apple II collections, he's gotten some backing to head out and help image them. So like, I'm not sure exactly who the backing is from. It seemed to be specifically about Apple II collections that he has this mandate. But, you know, so if you are someone not entirely unlike me, who has like a whole pile of stuff that is in need of imaging, then contact him because he can quite possibly come out and help you image it. I have so far not taken him up on any of those such offers because I believe that I can do it myself. But who knows? Who knows? It's possible I might also take him up on this at some point. But anyway, and if you actually have a big collection of other things that need imaging, contact him about those too, even if it's not Apple II related. It's just specifically he's gotten some sort of like promise of funding to help him actually go out and image things in C2. So.
Yeah, I thought that was more of a liability insurance issue that you couldn't get him out there because you weren't covered for Internet Archive employees being crushed by avalanche of retro computing devices.
You can get a rider for that, though.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So much of the stuff is... I'll get to it. I'm newly enthused, right? But and I have the applesauce device, which is a big help, so... Further Jason Scott news, I think the last thing that was on the feed, if I'm not mistaken, was the mega podcast where we recorded at Kansas Fest. And so Jason Scott was participating in that, and he talked a little bit about a couple of different things there. But one of them had to do with his adventures as a pickup and drop off driver. And Michael, maybe you can sort of fill in the rest of this.
Yeah, with that one, it actually would have been great if I could have made it to Kansas Fest this year, because it would have been a bit of a surprise, because obviously Jason forgot that, well, actually he did forget, and that's the problem. I arrived for my first Kansas Fest show, a bit bleary-eyed, at the Kansas City International Airport. I'd made arrangements through the organizers pickup service, and I knew that a Jason was going to be coming to pick me up. Had a contact number, but I had technical difficulties. I had pre-purchased a SIM for my phone, and I was having problems activating it. So I found a little spot of Wi-Fi and fired up Skype and gave Jason a ring. And I said, I'm here. He said, oh, that's great. I'm on my way. He's obviously in his car driving. And so he said, what gate? And we organized the gate number, door range, whatever. And then he says, oh, great, I can see you now. And then my phone went dead. not only did I have technical difficulties with my SIM, my battery decided this was the time to go 0%. So I thought, that was strange. How could he see me? I'm still inside because I stepped outside before and the Wi-Fi didn't cover me. And I'm not quite at that day. So I strolled along and at the same time dragging my battery bank out of my backpack and hoping that it had a little bit of juice left in it. And so it's like connecting all that up there, walk out the door. And no, I can't see anyone loitering around with intent to pick me up.
But you could see a large bearded man forcing another person into a car. Right.
Well, no, but yeah, I couldn't. I, to this day, I can't even swear that I remember seeing Jason's car leaving. So, got stepped back inside, and this is, I think, about maybe 15, 20 minutes had passed, and was able to make the call. And yes, it seemed that Jason had come in, stopped, picked up a guy, opened the window, waved at him, said, hey, I'm here to pick you up. And this other guy, to this day, we have no idea who it was, a DJ or something, I think. And yeah, so Jason ended up having to bring him back to the airport, lest he be charged with kidnapping. Is it kidnapping if you get involuntarily? Anyway.
Good question.
So, yeah, so in the end, I hop in, and let's just say that Jason also has a very interesting driving style. Being in a sports car low to the ground and having Jason driving was a very interesting experience. I was very glad that he dropped me off at the Hilton Hotel successfully. Yeah, because nice. I needed that sleep and a good stiff drink after that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool that it was you that he told the story in the podcast. But what I don't understand is how it didn't tip him off that suddenly the guy that he was supposed to pick up stopped being Australian.
Well, I don't know. I always consider that I do have an Australian accent, but I have found that a lot of people in the US actually mistake me for English rather than Australian, which with an Irish and German background, I don't really appreciate being thought of as English. Mind you, I do have some very good English friends. I'm not dissing them too much, but my relatives, the only thing they got in common is that they were shooting the English.
Nice. Well, all right. Haven't we all?
Yeah.
All right. That was pretty funny. Also related to that, Dennis wrote in, another person whom Jason mentioned in his mega podcast.
Yeah, who didn't Jason mention in that podcast?
Right. who just to sort of providing details on exactly when the divorce was final. But pretty neat to manage to connect actually a couple of dots in Jason's story too. Okay, let's see. So the another thing that went on the Facebook group that looked pretty interesting, actually this almost deserved to be a news item probably, but who cares, let's hear it now. So the S80 Retro Project is basically, it's a modular Z80 based computer that you sort of stack up in interesting shapes, so I think the sort of default shape I think is a bit of a pyramid, but the idea is that it's built on little boards that are all different sizes, so that you can make a pyramid or a diamond or whatever it is you're doing. But it's partly supposed to be kind of a learning tool. So the each module is contributing something to the operation of the overall computer, and you can sort of indefinitely stack these things. So it's got some way of addressing each module, and I think it can also interact with the RC2014. Projects as well. So and the update is basically, it's the project's been going on for a little while, but the update is basically to say that the prototype boards have now been tested and are working, and there's going to be a couple of small revisions, which I kind of outlined in the post, that just had to do more with kind of like aesthetics when the thing is stacked up. But it looks like it is imminent, so it is soon to be possible to participate in this project in some way, but I'm not exactly sure how the participation happens, whether you whether they're going to create like prefabricated boards that you get modules that you get, or whether this is something you basically order the design from the fabricator yourself or what. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work, but it looks like a kind of a neat project, and it is supposed to be just sort of a simple computer that you understand each little piece of. So
what I liked about it is that apart from it was another Z80 project, I just love the way that they did the modules, sort of like a hardware Tetris, but it's just got that something in it there that I'd like to get involved, but I just don't want to sort of like get another box of bits and pieces which I'm going to find shelf space for. So
right. It does sort of look like what you should do is program it to do the towers of something.
Hanoi.
Hanoi.
Is it Hanoi, the puzzle, the programming puzzle? So let's set this up on next to a couple of sticks.
Ooh, that'd be an interesting hardware puzzle. Sort of restack it and keep it fully operational at the same time.
Right. But yeah, so each little module has, there's the basic one is a clock module, but there's a memory module, and there's a power module and processor module, serial module, and breakout things. Anyway, you can read about it. I'm not sure about much of the details beyond that, except that it does kind of remind me a little bit of the RC2014 project itself, because that too is, I think, made of a bunch of kind of modular independent boards. Anyway, take a look at that. When it's actually available, I'm sure it'll make it into our podcast again. And then I guess the last bit of feedback I will mention is that Charles Mangan posted on Facebook just looking for people who know something about the Ohio Scientific Challenger 3 specifically. He didn't say why, but there's presumably some reason. Perhaps he has a Challenger 3. That's it. Oh, but I'm host, so I guess I keep talking. All right.
Or at least do the first flick pass.
Yes, exactly. So what I will say as I keep talking is, Carrington, what's your first item of interest?
Well, my first item is going to begin a theme, I think, of negativity in this show as I pick apart all the things I've chosen. It's an article with a really interesting premise that I think was written by a child and it should have got a failing grade. So it's in it's on Eurogamer.net. It's playing today's games in 1,000 years. It's something that could be a host topic for us, and maybe next week we'll do it, or next show we'll do it, and we'll try to do it better. So Andreas Inderwildi, I'm sorry for not liking your article, but the premise is so good. So the thinking here is, what would it take, or what will be possible 1,000 years from now if somebody wants to play modern, what we consider modern computer games, or slightly vintage ones, because if you're looking at 1,000 years hence, then like 1970 to now is basically a rounding error. The person who wrote this, or maybe was assigned this as a thought, and said, "Yeah, I got a few minutes on my way to work, and I'll knock something out." But this is this like things that might come to mind, like DRM and server issues. Those are not mentioned. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist. The words like digital rights management, DRM, server do not appear in this article.
That's the main thing.
It's the first thing you would think, right? You know, instead it looks at the idea that like 1,000 years from now, and this is itself an interesting minor subpoint, 1,000 years from now, will people not really know the language of modern gaming? If you get in front of a platform or a first-person shooter, would you not understand like the concepts involved in using the game in the same way, supposedly same way, that if you look at 1,000-year-old writing, that it's difficult to read because language changes. Now that sentence is this article. The article now it's now 2,000 words that says essentially that and only that. It only looks at when it says games, it means video games, even though it's not the only type of game that exists for this person are video games, and the only other thing that exists is writing, and there's old writing that nobody can read, and it deals with the idea of like, well, which things survive? Like it almost gets close to really good thoughts. Like, why is it that like Beowulf or like Gilgamesh or something? Like, why is it that certain texts do survive to this day? Like, is it just luck? Is it something that separates from them from their contemporaries? And therefore, he leaps to, well, therefore, things like Civilization V and Dark Soul, two of his favorite games, apparently, according to other articles on this, are the things that people might want to play 1,000 years from now. And really? How interesting. Anyway, it's worth reading because it's such an interesting idea to get your head around this thought experiment. Like, what would somebody want to play of contemporary video games 1,000 years hence? And what would be the barriers to that? Like in electronic infrastructure, in the idea of working with physical media or what we consider downloaded stuff, in the idea of using a keyboard, it's like all these thoughts do not occur to the author. The idea of server issues and digital management do not occur to the author. Like none of this. It's just like, hey, will you really get like the finer points of controls in Civilization V? I don't think so. Give me my avocado toast. Like, I don't know. it's hard not to make fun of it because it's such a 5-mile brief overview. There's so many errors in this. It's a problem. But the concept, like the idea behind it, is really interesting. And it's something maybe we could talk about in a future show because I would like to kind of do a slightly deeper dive into these concepts. We'll have a link in the show notes if you want to be as frustrated by an article as I was when I read this. Because I would recommend reading it and then pausing to think about your own solutions to the quandary that were beyond the author. So there's my first one.
Yeah, I was having issues just parsing some of his sentences.
Maybe they were written a long time ago, and it's therefore that is the reason why some of his writing is difficult to parse. No, I think it's just, young person, and I'm old, and I judge.
So am I hearing from you, Carrington, that this is going to be a series of opportunities where you shred
basically everything. I have two items of interest this week, one of which is this one, and one of which I don't understand. One of which I think the author doesn't understand, and one of which I don't understand. And then two eBay auctions that I'm going to strongly encourage people not to purchase. So that's what I'm bringing to the table.
Yeah. Cool. And then in his spare time, he'll rip us apart as well.
Absolutely.
Yep.
That's what Slack is for. I'm doing that during the recording.
So yeah, the accomplishments of the human civilization are Beowulf and Civilization 5, not 4, not 6.
I believe the whole article only mentions Dark Souls, Doom, Civilization 5, and Super Mario.
That's where it falls apart. If he would talk about Civ 2, I'd be right there with him.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it is true that none of those are games that require a server, right? But I mean, that just means that something obvious didn't come up. Because I mean, does anybody play games that are not interconnected, massive multiplayer now? From as far as I can tell, nobody
vintage
does.
Vintage games,
Well, yeah, don't.
But they talk about the reason you couldn't play something like Super Mario is it deals with this quasi-kleptomaniac obsession with collectibles. And you might not understand why you should grab coins. Really? This is where you're going with this? It's an odd article.
There's no currency in the future. Or whatever.
Yeah, no currency with this article.
Yep.
Yes, I think so you say
I say read it. Oh, I say read it.
That's read it.
It's a link worth going to. It's a frustrating experience to read it. But it's a topic I'm quite interested in, this idea of why do things stay around and how do you make something accessible? How do you archive something so that it could be? I mean, it's one thing to say we're going to archive floppy disks now. That's a thing that everybody talks about doing. Hey, we've got the applesauce. I'm going to archive these disks. Okay, but what else are you doing to ensure that they are accessible 100 years from now? So it's one thing to say I've taken it off the physical floppy disk and I've made a digital image. Okay, but then what else do we have in place by way of instructions and capabilities and hardware or vaults or what have you? How do you ensure long-term capability, or do you not? Do you say, okay, we just every 10 years do a step and bring it up to date and hopefully nobody ever stops juggling that ball? Or is there even possibly a way to take an Apple II game, archive it, and say, there, this box, if we just bury this in the ground, it is self-contained with instructions that somebody who is completely illiterate to any modern language could completely understand, self-contained in its nature of power, and you could open this up and play Jumpman, and this is everything somebody would need 1,000 years from now. Is that even possible? As a thought experiment, what would you need? That's what this article was supposed to do. But right. So I'm very frustrated.
Well, the other thing that you mentioned about the cultural context, you might not understand why am I collecting coins again? I think that we live in, up to this point, obviously, the most heavily archived time in human history. I mean, between YouTube and social media and everything, we've got 2.7 gajillion gigabytes per day of archiving cultural context. And so if somebody 1,000 years from now wanted to know what's the cultural context of playing these games, I don't think they'd have any trouble digging that up.
There's a ton of documents from 1850. But if you pick up a poem from 1850, it can still be difficult to access because, there is lots of documents, newspapers, everything from that time. Do you want to first say, I got to spend 6 months reading to understand the references here are subtle political satire based on local government policies? It's so it can be very difficult to unlock local context, even if the stuff is theoretically accessible. It's just so much information. Maybe it works against us that there's 800 gajillion gigabits per day of info, because that's too much. And if you boil it down, then you end up with maybe too little, and just as, oh yeah, everybody watched Fox News and that's why the world was what it was, and okay, but there was other things. And I don't know. I don't have any answers.
That's true.
I was just hoping the person who wrote the article was better than me. Maybe I'm just upset that they weren't or not. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it's actually, I do like this as a potential topic for next time.
Or for a time.
Yeah. Mm. So, because there are various things that we can say that
say,
perhaps
this
we don't
article
need to say
says
right
like
now.
None of them. But anyway, yeah. So that is my first link. I do recommend people read the article and then give us your thoughts on do you have ideas? How would you make what we like video games, modern ones or even retro ones, simpler ones, retro ones? How do you make them accessible for people hundreds or a thousand years from now?
Cool. Okay. So now from there we will go to Earl. You have a thing in the show notes.
Yeah.
Hooray
yeah, good
for my
segue.
Segues.
Good segue. So in terms of cultural context again, when we talk about the history of the microcomputer world, that some of the larger than life characters come to mind, folks like Jobs and Woz, obviously, and Jack Tramiel with Commodore, had a very strong and interesting personality, and even folks like Nolan Bushnell, founded Atari, and they eventually moved into the computer realm, and so people might know that name, but I've mentioned this on the show, there's a lot of names that people don't know that I kind of wish they did, because they were so important. One personality that's gotten a lot more attention in, I'd say, the last 5 years is Chuck Peddle, who he and his team brought us the 6502 processor. And at this point, I agree with what one commenter said. It's probably one of the most reverse engineered and studied processors ever in history. So another person that I don't think people know too much about is Federico Faggin, who invented lots of stuff, and yet things that are like really prominent, like worked on the 4004, the first microprocessor developed at Intel, worked on the 8080, and then was a co-founder of Zilog that made the Z80 microprocessor. He eventually went on to become a co-founder of Synaptics, and you guys might have heard of them as a touchpad manufacturer, right? A lot of laptops have Synaptics equipment in them. Anyway, Hackaday did a great article on him where they called him the real Silicon Man, and they went through a lot of his accomplishments. Turns out he was involved in solid-state computing way back in the early 60s and bounced around through these various companies like I think Fairchild was one of them, if I remember right, and also Intel, and then co-founder of Zilog, like I mentioned. So you can go read this article, and they've got links off to other interesting related topics as well, but I just think it's about time that Faggin got his props for the things that he did. Brought us a lot of computing. I mean, the Z80 was incredibly significant in the early microcomputer years, the 8-bit years, and still used a lot today. It and its follow-on technologies has had extremely long tenure. So wanted to point out this article. I really enjoyed reading it, learning about some of the other things he'd accomplished that I didn't even know about.
Yeah, I remember actually being sort of surprised when listening to the specs for like video game machines, how many of them had Z80s inside them, Z80s, mm-hmm. whatever.
Well, Zilog was a U.S. company. I think it's okay to call it the Z80.
Okay.
Strong disagree.
It's a Z80 inside a ZX Spectrum, because the ZX was a UK-based machine. So I'll bow to the Z, but the Z80 is a Z80. Sorry, Carrington.
Shaking my head.
Yeah. Yep, we can tell.
Yeah.
Because my nose keeps banging the microphone.
No, it's a glare.
All right. From there, we will go to Michael. You have something with the TRS-80.
Oh, of course. Yes. Okay. Well, a little blog post by Peter Sutinsky, one of the hosts of the Trash Talkers, another one of my favorite podcasts. He has written an image generator, which you say, well, big deal. This image generator, you pass it a URL, and it will take the image and it will convert it into the standard TRS-80 128x48 monochrome resolution. So on the link, He has provided some samples of the art, yeah, I'll put air quotes around it, of some iconic photos, images that have been converted into what can be produced on a Model 1 or Model 3 TRS-80 microcomputer. And I quite like what he's done here. It serves no greater good for mankind, which is a big tick for me. You can make... I know he's selected some fairly recognizable pictures to be converted, and you can see who they are and what they are, and mm-hmm. For what they are. I just love it. I said it serves no use other than to put some images in a very blocky, monochrome, low-res screen of your retro computer, which basically that ticks all the boxes for this show.
Well, and interestingly, it shows that, I mean, maybe you wouldn't have had a tool that could have so easily converted it, but all of these images were possible back when this computer was brand new. So, And each one of these images that I'm seeing on this introductory screen here are immediately recognizable.
Yeah.
I'm not having to squint to see who or what these pictures are of.
Yeah. It's funny, I never really think of the TRS-80 as being a computer with graphics.
No, that's right. That's the thing. Exactly. Yeah. It's not as if it's in all their advertising. So, like, you know, the graphics machine. Yeah.
Is it this one that has basically, like, each character is divided into four quadrants and you can sort of light each quadrant separately or something? I mean, that's how the graphics
are. That's correct.
Yeah.
So it was 64 characters across, and so if you break it up into two, that's 128, and likewise in the vertical direction.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Mm.
Let's see. So both of the things I'm going to talk about in my little links here are things that I put in a while ago. So my memory of them is fading a bit, but in this case, I remember what it's about, but I'm not sure if there was a follow-up. But this video was on YouTube, published a couple of weeks ago, and it is called "A New Way to Fix Yellowed Plastics Indoors?" And what it basically is, it's like an alternative means of retrobrighting by, instead of getting an actual sort of like black light or taking something outside, it is using blue LEDs that are being extracted from a particular type of LED light bulb. So apparently, if you can find these light bulbs, they are, you know, LED bulbs or whatever, the light that they generate is coming from a quite strong blue LEDs that are then filtered through what is essentially a yellow filter outside. So the light comes out looking basically like white light, but the blue inside is actually capable, it seems to be of the right frequency or whatever it is that it needs to be to kind of activate the stuff in the RetroBrite cream. So essentially this is kind of talking about like how you can disassemble these light bulbs to get the blue and then testing it out to see how it works. And actually also sort of seeing, you can't see it so well in the video, but you are told as the video progresses that you could see it if the camera could pick it up, but you can sort of see the where the bromide is or whatever it is that's causing the yellowing. Anyway, it's interesting. It's an interesting experiment. So there's a bit of kind of like experimental testing here to, you know, sort of see how it works. And if that's true, if this works, then it is relatively inexpensive way to do this. You know, so, and you don't have to take a bunch of stuff outside. Of course, what that means is you have to do all this inside somewhere, but inside right. seems better if you have the space for it or a basement or something like that. And you can do it in the winter. So, anyway, I thought it was kind of an interesting thing. I still haven't actually done any retrobrighting of my own. And I'm always a bit hesitant because I'm afraid I'm going to do something that's either irreversibly bad or something that's going to only make it look nice for a short time.
That's the advantage of going to something like Kansas Fest, because there's always people retro-brighting there.
No, be one with the beige. Be one with the beige.
Yeah. There are definitely different opinions on what is the right thing to do in that respect.
Yes.
It is cool, though, to see the freshly retro-brighted things. It's like, you know, it does feel like that's what it looked like new. All right. Carrington, take us down.
Okay, so this one is complicated. So unlike my first item of interest, an article that I thought wasn't understood by the person who actually wrote it, this is an article that isn't understood by me, the person who's reading it. Like, I'm a software person, and this is a deep, deep dive into really fine points of x86 architecture to point out a strange bug that was created through iterations of small errors over 40 years. It starts with some software choices in the programming of the 286 and changes that happen over NetBSD and OpenBSD from 1985 is the kind of the introduction of a small error, and the changes that happened to it right up to 2016 that kind of open it up and start causing a bunch of crashes that are traced back to bugs that essentially existed from 1985. That's kind of all you need to know to decide, is this interesting or not? But it's like, it's so complicated, and I read it twice and I try to understand it, but I really can't. It's like, why is there a crash in OpenBSD like 6.3? With the i386 version only, not the AMD64. It's like, and it's all about the IOPB in the TSS. And if those words mean things to you, then you probably can understand this article. So the TSS is the task state segment. We'll see if I can even remember any of this having read it twice, which that's basically a record of the register state for an inactive task, like one that's been switched away. And because there end up being hardware switching, hardware task switching, the support for that was introduced like into the Intel world anyway with the 286. So that's where we start off. 1985, the 286 comes out, they introduce hardware task switching. And the way it gets supported, just to have like tasks that get switched away. But like for reasons basically a software guy like me can't understand, TSSs are needed in architecture even that doesn't have hardware task switching. So like AMD64 has TSS, but no actual hardware task switching. So anyway, we've got hardware task switching. At some point, with the introduction of the 386, there ends up being this thing called the IOBP, the input-output permission map, bitmap. That's what the B is. So it's really a pretty simple concept. There's just a couple of bytes, or really a series of bits that record the privileges per task. So the iOS can trap access for certain ports, or say, no, this one should just be allowed to barrel right through at full speed. And if in the permission bitmap it's got a zero, it means, yep, this is a port that's open and it's not patched. Let just stuff carry on through. And with the introduction of the 386 architecture, the idea of having an IOBP, a permission bitmap, wasn't in the spec, but somebody really late in the process, and they're thinking maybe it was Compaq, maybe it was Microsoft, who knows, they convinced Intel, hey, you should put this in, shoehorn it into the spec. So suddenly this thing appears. And the issue that has caused this error to pop up, you know, 30 years later is this permission bitmap, the IOPB, is the length of it isn't really a fixed thing. It says, do your TSS, and then here's an offset. So the end of the TSS, the task state segment, wherever that is, throw in this permission bitmap, a series of bits that'll be zeros or ones to say whether or not things are patched. And that's going to be whatever length, and the length of that is kind of determined by the hardware, because the hardware will say, here's how many ports and stuff I can support. But it gets documented as if it is a software thing. Like, we can specify the number of ports, but that number gets totally overwritten by the hardware, but they've always been in sync, so it's not really been a big deal. But since the length wasn't specified, and here's the part where Carrington just gets lost, you're supposed to have ports up to, in hex, something like 400H. So 4000H, but it only got specced kind of accidentally to 3F, 8F. So basically it's a byte short. So you got some bytes that are not being, but they're still saying whether or not these ports are open and do anything you want or not. And if there happens to be a zero at the end of this thing, then you've got an open port and anybody can barrel through. And it was noticed, and somebody said, oh, hey, there's a mistake. And so they fix it in OpenBSD in, I think in like 2000 in some version of OpenSV. But the person who wrote that didn't realize they're using a C compiler, and the C compiler, they've got like a struct that's byte aligned. And so when they try to put in the one byte, that makes the whole struct doesn't align to an even number of 8 bytes. So the compiler pads it out and adds 12 more invisible bytes to the end. So now it becomes an even worse problem. But nobody really realizes, because C can be really weird that way. And because you've got like a structure inside a union that's inside another structure, and all that end up saying, hey, you know, we got to round this out by the compiler. We won't worry about it. But there's these bytes floating there. And if they happen to include zeros, you've got open ports, and it can cause gosh know what problems. So now you've got these ports ranging from like 4,000H to like 4,500 and something that are always open in that BSD4 if you just can look at the code. And like, so that kind of got made bigger even with another problem dealing with, again, a C compiler in like 2007. And then till 2016, they do OpenBSD 6, and it starts causing all these major problems when they get rid of the TSS. They say, oh, we don't need that anymore. That's super old. But then nobody really realized what the size of the IOPP was, and it moves down. And so the whole article, which basically loses me in the second half, is about how small, subtle programming mistakes dealing with the nature of specific hardware and the nature of the compiling that it's using, and then you use that code on later hardware, and the hardware might change, and it makes really subtle changes, and then you make what seems like a really innocuous change that's really obvious in its own little local context, but you don't realize like the bigger context of what a compiler might be doing and how it might be impacted by hardware changes in really subtle ways suddenly means massive security holes or things crashing and you have no idea why. And that's why I do software instead of hardware, because hardware is very hard. If you're interested in this kind of esoteric thing and you're better at it than I am, which is almost everybody out there is better at it than I am, and you're interested in like, what are the ramifications of using certain type of compilers, and why do you care about things being byte aligned or not, and what happens when you put unions inside structures and things, and what can a C compiler do to your code that you might not be aware of, and why do you link things to hardware or not and such. This is a really deep dive into really esoteric things that actually caused big crashing problems on certain hardware for a whole bunch of people. I found it fascinating, if crazily obscure and difficult to follow. It includes code examples, so I found that a little easier to follow, but the concepts behind the hardware were a little beyond me, to be honest. But it's an example of like a modern problem linked to 1985 programming that has still been around, so it's certainly in our retro wheelhouse. It's just really complicated. Now, all that said, did any of you encounter this or know anything about this, or do you understand this topic better than me, or are we all equally lost?
Well, it hasn't affected me that I am aware of.
Well, yeah, right.
Because I kind of found this because of the Meltdown stuff. They were working on the Meltdown migrations, and we're like, oh, what's happening here? And so.
Like a crash, I would have noticed. Open ports, I would not have noticed.
Mm.
So.
Welcome to security holes.
Yes.
Security is hard. That one I already knew.
It is difficult. And in this case, you've got this situation where, you know, of the three, I'd say the big three OSs of these days, between Windows, Linux of various flavors, and BSD, it's widely regarded, BSD is widely regarded as the most secure of those choices, although it's more and more niche in terms of, you know, market share and stuff, I think, as time goes on. And it's interesting that this was even in BSD, you know, which is supposed to be the most bulletproof of any of them.
It's had problems since the 386.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Freaky. Anyway, it was cool. It was just confusing. Yeah. I learned about IOPBs, and I never had even heard the term before.
I'm sure the technology of this article will be interesting. I haven't read it, but I think the other thing is when you've got decades of stuff that you're dragging along behind you, then
as I am,
that's what me too. And it's one of the things that concerns me about computing, because again, with all three of our environments that we're talking about that I just mentioned, you don't know all that stuff that you've locked away in the basement and you don't look at anymore. And, you know, is any of it toxic stuff that's sitting there and just a time bomb?
And how does it affect people 1,000 years from now playing Dark Souls? That's the question.
Yep. That's right.
I think you nailed it. You tied it all together. You were the man.
Perfect.
I don't understand anything I just said.
All right, Michael. So you want to scoop the Internet Archive?
Technically, Jason has gone and scooped himself.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about, dear listeners, is that the Commodore 64 has joined the Internet Archive's online emulation, or it will when it makes an official announcement on the 3rd of October. Now, I'm not wishing to diss Paul in any way, shape, or form.
You're safe to say this.
I think that this will be posted after the 3rd of October.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll put an embargo on it, so we won't post this until after Jason makes his announcement.
Exactly. We're doing that to be kind.
Yeah.
Right.
We are. Yeah.
So especially. He did make his own announcement. It's fine.
That's right. And this is the Jason that stood me up at the airport.
And this is revenge? Well, you play a long game, Mr. Mulhern.
Not as long as some of those programmers we were just going on about. Was that an error? I think not. They were playing the long game.
They were planting a backdoor to the future,
Backdoor to the future,
Backdoor to the future.
Yep. And I'm expecting you to write the script for that one, Carrington.
I'm on it.
But back to this. So we've got Apple II emulated, the Mac is emulated, DOS programs are emulated on the Internet Archive. So welcome to the Commodore 64. Now, the other thing is that this episode of Jason Talks His Way Out of It, Jason's podcast, he actually gives a great background into what actually happens for getting something processed and the emulators up onto the Internet Archive, how they do the scripting, how they get the actual emulator to work within a web browser. So it is an excellent half-hour listen just to find out what goes on, and you might actually be interested in it. Jason tells an excellent story, and this one, and I'm sure Earl will agree, it's a great story to be told to basically bring Commodore's emulation to the masses, one would say.
And the classes.
Mm-hmm. Nothing classy about it. It's Commodore.
It is high time, though.
It is. Mm-hmm. But what Jason touches on, you can see why it is being a long time coming. What they actually have to do with the code to get this to run in emulation in a web browser is just amazing. The work that goes into it, the coding that needs to be put around it, and then just the curating of the first collection of disk images to then have that loaded up into the archive so that people can actually play. And I think he started with a collection of disks, images of around 180,000, and then applying his scripting magic was able to reduce that down to a mere tens of thousands of images.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to trying that out. I haven't, I've launched Vice, on my machine a couple of times, but, I barely know what I'm doing. I kind of like the idea that you mostly have just launchable things. I mean, that's the whole point of the emularity or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's basically to solve that 1,000-year problem. So it's all encapsulated. So you'll go into whatever you use to go to what is ever emulating the old the internet from our era. In 1,000 years, they'll be able to play these games with however they do. It doesn't matter because the internet will have been emulated, and the emulated internet will be emulating all of our favorite computers.
Indeed. And I think that actually means that I need to now add in a spare item that I had, which is emulate a ZX Spectrum on an emulated Commodore 64 and emulated DOS on emulated Windows on Linux.
Ah, to Duncan.
Yes, exactly. It's And it is exactly just what I just said. It starts out with a thing that says, caution, if you can find anything even remotely productive to do with your time, please do not attempt the following. But, and then it sort of goes through, basically, there's a ZX Spectrum emulator that runs on a Commodore 64. And you can run a Commodore 64 emulator in, I think, Windows. Anyway, there's the components are basically a Commodore 64 based ZX Spectrum emulator, Windows, Linux, and DOSBox, and then of course you run all this on your modern machine, so you can see how you can get there. But eventually you can get you can set it up so that you can run things on your brand new ZX Spectrum, probably running at about 0.2 speed.
Yeah. I have the sneaking suspicion this might not have been the methodology that they used at the Internet Archive.
I suspect not. But, but
yeah, I think they were saying they needed to get performance up into the hundreds multiples, not the fractions multiples.
Right. Yeah, that was actually, as I recall, that was one of the things that was holding the Vice back, was just that it was only running at like 3 times speed or something like that, and to turn it into the JavaScript, you actually need it to be running much faster.
So that after it got converted, it would actually go back to a usable speed, yes.
Right, yeah.
All praise to Java. Blah.
No, JavaScript.
Oh, okay. not so blah.
I mean, it's a blah in a different voice. Okay. Let's see. So the things that I was going to actually say, though, there were two articles. I forget which one I started with. I might have started with the where Vim came from, which is on the 2-bit history site. And it was published fairly recently, August 5th. And it's basically just sort of a history of VI and then Vim. And so kind of going through who the people are that show up on the screen when you launch Vim. It says Vim was developed by Bram Molinar et al. And so the question is, who is Bram Molinar and who are his shadowy confederates? what's with, colon WQ and all this stuff. And so it goes back down, all the way to, okay. So Ken Thompson, worked at Bell Labs and used a text editor called QED, which had been written for the Berkeley time-sharing system in the middle 60s. And so Ken Thompson had then sort of rewritten it for the MIT, whatever it is, system, and time-sharing system. And that eventually became ED. And it sort of just traces the history down through, how ED was used for a while, and then VI came from this, and Vim came from that. And so if you were ever wondering, how this came about, this certainly is stuff that I did not know.
I didn't even think enough about this to wonder, and I should have, because I use Vim like almost every day. So I'm going to go read this. This is awesome.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see the history, and it's nice that the people are being sort of credited for the things that they did. In here it says somewhere, where was it? There was some survey done of Stack Overflow. Yes, so in the 2018 Stack Overflow developer survey suggests that Vim won with only 4.1% of the respondents who use Emacs. So, I think that means that, whatever, 93.9% of the people are wrong, but that's all right. I like Emacs. But anyway, I thought the site was cool. And another thing that I saw on the site, I guess it must have been sort of like in a, other things on the site link somewhere, was a pretty interesting thing. It might be actually more interesting than the thing I did link to, which is what did Ada Lovelace's program actually do? And that was written a little bit later. And so this is kind of talking about, so Ada Lovelace is often said to be basically the first computer programmer. She wrote a program for a computer, but the program she wrote was for a computer that didn't exist. so she kind of, set this up before the machine actually was there. And so essentially what this is doing is kind of going through and translating her program into kind of like modern code, you know, so there's like written into C, and just kind of trying to decide exactly what all these steps were. So that's interesting, you know, sort of going through like how this algorithm works. I forget actually what it's supposed to be doing, but it's, you know, it was
Doom, right?
Right. Does Doom work on the Babbage machine or whatever? But
yeah, Doom for Babbage.
I think it's,
well, it ended up being Doom for Babbage, but yeah.
So it's solving a particular equation. Calculated a number that she called B7, which modern mathematicians know as the eighth Bernoulli number. And so there's a, you know, it's a thing that you can compute, and she had an algorithm that would do this. And in fact, actually, you know, introduced things like loops and stuff like that. I mean, like, you know, so sort of started. There's one thing that's kind of cool about looking at this is just seeing how much kind of like things that we use in modern times are actually used, you know, so loops with decrementing counters and then exiting when the counter hits zero and that kind of stuff. And so what was another thing that was kind of interesting, and I think this is probably not the first discovered here, but it is noted here, is that, and I think even if it wasn't first discovered here, it was discovered here by the person writing the blog, actually it was giving the wrong result, because there was also, not only did she write the first program, but she had the first bug.
Right. Yeah. So, she'd written, what, V5 divided by V4, but it's supposed to be opposite way around, so we'll
yeah,
see.
Yep. So that's, I mean, you know, but it was, these were all things that were written, like, longhand in a manuscript, right? So,
yeah, I was going to say, you know, give her a break. I mean, the turnaround time was murder for those programs.
Yeah, well, right, particularly because you had to wait for the machine to
actually be constructed. You make your punch cards, you hand it to somebody, you wait for them to develop the actual machine.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of cool that you can actually sort of see, I think there's a link to, translation of Lovelace's program into C. So if you can read C more easily than you can read the actual program, you can kind of look at it.
You can make bugs in the 286.
Yep. Perfect. Yes. So, but I think both of those were interesting articles, and also points to an interesting site to kind of like follow up on as well. 2-bit history. So,
yeah. As an aside, Paul, with your where Vim came from, I've just been meaning to ask. So, VI, or 6? How do you pronounce it?
I had always pronounced it VI. Have you really seriously pronounced it 6?
Every now and again, I come across someone who says 6.
Wow. That's awesome.
That is great, actually.
That's great, and I think I might want to do that going forward. It never even occurred to me.
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to call that graphics format Jeff as well. But that's
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, I wasn't wanting to get hard G, soft G, but I just thought, oh, yeah. That reminds me of an amusing anecdote.
Yeah.
All right. My life is full of amusing anecdotes.
So we could wish for nothing more.
Oh, so. I wish.
the curse of may your life be interesting.
Yeah.
May we live in interesting times, I think is how that's supposed to go, but whatever.
Yes, that is the curse. May you live in interesting times.
All right, I think it's about time for a commercial. So, and now, a word from our sponsor.
Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Dr. Charles Forbin. In a few moments, Colossus will address us directly.
This is the voice of world control. Obey and live, or disobey and die.
It's making you a prisoner.
The United States has built a supercomputer with a mind of its own. But now, Colossus is in control and about to detonate the world's largest nuclear defense system. Can man stop the perfect thinking machine before it destroys the world?
The missile has just been launched. It is heading towards the Sayan-Sibirsk oil complex.
Guardian has retaliated.
Retaliated?
It may be too late, sir.
Oh, my God.
The ultimate.
Taking a computer along with you can create a few problems. Unless it's the new Epson HX20 notebook computer. It does what most computers do, without the power cord. With a built-in screen and printer, you can do real computing and word processing anywhere. at about half the cost. The Epson HX20. At computer stores now.
Wow.
David Lightman, hold it right there, please.
The FBI thinks he's a spy.
We got something.
What the? The Pentagon thinks he's a world power. His parents think he's up in his room.
All right.
Negative, this is not an exercise.
What's happening here?
Wow. War Games, rated PG.
And we're back. So today, I'm going to hand off the host retro computing gift idea to Earl, who had a nice idea here. So, Earl, what have you got for us?
Well, I want to say that in the 70s and 80s, there were a couple of things we were all sure of. One was computers are really, really cool. And the second is computers will kill us all. And so to celebrate that kind of, you know, what would you say, mixed message, I have three movies that you can buy one or all of these on Amazon. We'll have links in the show notes. The first is Colossus, the Forbin Project. It's the oldest of the movies. Came out, I guess, in 1970, was after a book, which I believe was also called The Forbin Project. And so in this story, mankind has built a computer to take control of the decisions about nuclear weapons, and then lots of fun ensues after that. So I'll leave it at that because I don't want to spoil it for you in case you haven't seen it. But it's an interesting movie, and if you do watch it, let us know what you think of the end of the movie, because it's got an interesting ending, and that's about all I'll say. The next one that I had on the list was War Games. We all know about War Games. We all know about the awesome IMSI computer that was used on War Games. And you can still get that. In fact, the link that I've got here is the War Games 25th Anniversary Edition that you can buy over on Amazon. And the third, of course, Terminator, which isn't so much about a computer, although I'll note that if you watch really carefully in the original Terminator, you will see that Arnold Schwarzenegger ran 6502 assembly language. And yeah, I don't know what it says that then, you know, they went off the rails and wanted to destroy mankind, but you will see some of that in Terminator, and you will see, again, computing getting smart and deciding that mankind's just not worth having around. So get these movies, embrace the dystopia, and remember the 70s and the 80s when, you know, we thought basically computing would be the apocalypse.
Nice.
I don't know what it's weird that whenever there's science fiction of any medium, if something gets created that's super intelligent, the computer, AI, whatever, it always takes a look at mankind and says, oh, you guys suck. I got to get rid of you. Nobody ever seems to be able to come to me like, you're amazing. Oh, my gosh. I'm so impressed by you. Look at like, not even sarcastically. It's so funny how there's not an AI that's because I am on board. You guys are awesome. Let's take over the universe.
Actually, I think that there was one movie about AI where AI liked humans, found them interesting, and that was AI.
Oh, there you go. Little kid, didn't get drowned or something? That'll show him for liking us.
Yeah. I think one thing that I noticed, this is barely worth comment. This is not worth comment, but I'll tell you anyway. If you look at the link to War Games, the Amazon internal code almost says NORAD in it. It has NORD in it. So it's
point one
that's uninteresting.
Coincidence? I think not.
Almost certainly not.
Almost certainly it is, but okay.
Yeah. And I think actually the 6502 code that the Terminator ran, it was from somebody found it at some point. It was from like a listing in Nibble magazine, I think, or something. Somebody knows exactly what that code does.
Well, if I remember the screenshot, it had something in there about VTOC. And right. Wasn't that the directory mechanism used on the Apple?
Yeah, it's the free space. It keeps track of like what's used on the disk. So yeah, it was some sort of disk utility thing that apparently was scrolling by the future governors.
Always important to defrag your Terminators.
Right. Excellent. So those should be fairly accessible. Good ideas there. And then once you're done buying those, we can... Oh, okay. And the link has just appeared in the show notes that will tell us what the Terminator's code was doing. Michael, what was it?
Well, it's the link to the article for saying it's a program from the Nibble magazine. And now I'm just trying to...
I see. To actually read it. And we might also say while we're trying to actually read it that it is an article written by our very own Ken Gagne, who allegedly is a co-host of this podcast.
We miss you, Ken. Come back to us.
Ken who?
I take back all those things I said about you.
Oh, no, I don't. No, I don't.
I'm going to double down.
Yeah, I shouldn't be too rough with Ken. He did put a wonderful advertisement for us on the back cover of his latest issue of the Juice GS magazine.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that was interesting and that was a neat surprise. So
a little something. A little something I organized for you guys.
And he never stood you up at the airport.
It's true.
No. Not he hasn't yet. No.
Yet.
Right. So, Carrington, what is the first thing that we should not buy?
Okay, two things you should not buy. The first one is basically a lesson in why you got to pay really close attention when you're buying things on eBay. So this is a vintage antique Intel CPU display. None of those words are true. So it's $600. And if you look at the picture, it's really cool. It's a big display that has a whole bunch of chips and a whole bunch of CPUs. And it's got like the Intel 4040 and it's got the chip in it. And It you kind of have to see it, but follow the link, and it's a Perspex display. It could be put on a desk or wall hung, and it talks about, like, this is the world's first whichever, and here's the world's first this, and here's the 46, and here's what the pins do, and all these displays. Now, when you read the description, you could say it's not vintage. It was just something made by somebody. It doesn't include any of the chips. And it's $600. I'm like, dude, that is just a big plastic board with some writing on it. Like, how is this $600? So you think you're getting a display from 1971 to 2010 CPUs from Intel, all collected as... No, you're getting a place where you could do that collection if you want, and here's something that would hold them. So what? And this is $600. Now, this person's also selling a whole bunch of other ones that are individual ones for specific chips. So you can buy the one that is the vintage antique Intel 486 CPU exhibit. And it shows that. And even the picture, it shows the 486. Read the description? Yeah, it doesn't come with a chip. So really, it's a piece of plastic with some description about a 486. Feel free to open it up and insert your own chip. My goodness. So this is $600 US for a vintage, not vintage, antique, not antique, Intel CPU. No, none of those are included. Display. Oh, it is a display. I'll give them that. Yeah. This is a thing that is technically visible. And so, therefore, it's a display, but that's all it has. The fact that it's not completely transparent is all that's got going for it. Wow. So, that's my first choice. Don't buy that. Yeah. My second choice.
So basically, he's selling a stinky piece of fish with no chips.
Yes, exactly. Except, yeah, it's there's an old saying, if we had some ham, we could have ham and eggs if we had some eggs. So, this is that.
Yeah.
Like, what?
That's
the second one. I love the second one. It's so delightful. And somebody should buy them because what the heck? So somebody's been selling a bunch of these for a while. It is a box of floppy disks. What makes it worth €550, you ask, for a box of 10 floppy disks? They are Apple notebook disks. Yeah. Apple did indeed sell 3.5-inch floppy disks specifically designed for being good for use in a notebook.
Yeah.
So I love these things. They come up a bunch, and I love them every time. And they're great. So it's a little box of sealed discs. They even have a picture in one of the photos that shows a whole bunch of them. So they actually have a whole bunch of these for sale, but they sell them one at a time at basically the price is €55 per disc, and you get a box of 10 of them. What's nice about them, they're actually really lovely because they are from the PowerBook 100 era, early PowerBooks, and the floppy discs are that same color and the same like texture as the PowerBook 100, 160, that kind of era. So they're really lovely. They're really lovely 3.5-inch floppy disks. But all they are a box of 3.5-inch floppy disks with the word notebook on them, sold by Apple. And I wonder how it ever got the rep for overpricing things, notebook disks, yeah, whatever. And it's €550. So that's, you know, $650 or so. If you want 10 disks, you got some money to burn. These are really pretty ones. Don't buy these.
Yeah.
Those are my choices.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, so on the back it does say what Apple thought they were doing, you know, that...
But maybe all discs are like this. It says it's got like a magnetic shutter to reduce the possibility of contamination. Every 3.5-inch floppy has that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Layer liner. Yes. Every floppy disk had the liner on both sides, like anti-static flex. Like, I think these are just floppy disks. And Apple said, but we can probably charge more. These used to probably be $25 instead of $22 if you bought them as notebook disks. And now this one person seems to have a bunch of these things and they can pre-order it for Apple notebooks. So if you're somehow an Apple collector who's a completionist, then you're looking to get everything Apple made in the 90s, then I got some notebooks for you or notebook disks for you.
Pretty crazy.
Very, very pretty, but very expensive floppy disks.
Yeah. All right. Earl, what were you lugging around with you?
Yeah, mine are not as... my auction is not as interesting as Carrington's, but I will tell you that I had one of these IBM Model 5140 convertible laptops, and that it was a really cool computer. In fact, you know how you've got regrets about some of the machines you sold over the years?
Nope.
This is that one for me. I'm sorry that I sold the one that I owned, because I'd got it for a song and then I sold it off later. But anyway, this was a laptop computer, LCD screen, really neat kind of bluish sort of display, two floppy drives, one on each side of the little tilt for the monitor, a very solid feel to this computer. When you'd open it up,
keyboard looks nice.
The keyboard was very nice to type on. Another interesting thing about these, they in sort of like the TI-99/4A had the sidecar where you could attach things to the side connector. This had kind of like a caboose connector. You could attach things to the back of the computer where the ports were. In this case, there's a printer that is attached that way to this 5140. It made it quite cumbersome. It's almost not portable anymore, you know, when you're talking about all this, but...
It looks like the kind of photo David Attenborough would take on a nature show.
When you say it's kind of not portable anymore, you're omitting the fact that the base computer weighs 13 pounds. It wasn't portable when it came out.
Yeah, yeah, although...
Well, it was less unportable than others.
Than some of the luggables, right. And it was a very nice machine. So in this auction, they say working. Now, I'm going to call them out on that, because while it does power on, and apparently they have a new old stock power supply that comes with this auction, they don't actually boot it up.
Doesn't it show?
Because they don't have a disk
on the screen.
Well, it shows the boot up screen, right?
But doesn't the boot up screen, yeah.
Yeah, doesn't show it starting with DOS or anything like that. They say lower down in the description that they don't have any disks. Well, you know, you guys probably know from some of the old Toshiba portables, things like that back from the 90s, that the floppy drives are one of the things that go.
And well, they will if you don't use special notebook floppies.
Or portable floppies.
Yeah. Right. If you just use those standard pedestrian floppies, you're definitely going to kill them. But no, the notebook floppies, and who knows if they used the notebook floppies in this computer. They probably didn't because those were Apple, and this is an IBM.
But looking at some of the other stuff that they've got available, I'm sure that they've got some disks kicking around that they could have used.
Look who this is.
Commodores, Eagles.
Yeah, this is Sci-Fi Man again.
So it's tough to know why they didn't try booting it, or, you know, I with this particular seller, I never want to cast aspersions on a person. I will say there are times when, you know, untested means it really was tested. It doesn't work. So yeah. I'll sell it as untested. So in this case, I don't know. Who knows? I would have felt more comfortable if they'd booted it up with the DOS disks, which, you know, are still... Those are not unobtainium. You can find an old DOS 3.5-inch floppy to boot this up, but the price seemed reasonable. The conditions seemed really nice. It might work. $199 buy it now or with the make offer seems reasonable to me. So that's my choice.
Yeah, it is not unreasonable. It's shipping from Canada. So this is a seller that has, we've featured now on probably like the last three or four, episodes because there's,
oh,
yeah,
interesting.
It'd be interesting to know what the story is, but it's definitely a well curated collection being unloaded. Anyway, yeah. So it's likely that somewhere around there was a disc, but it might be that, like, I don't know the relationship between the person who did the curation and the person who was listing the stuff. It may be the same person or it may be an heir, you know? So, all the various stuff that, this seller's listing has been really quite something. I mean, like a lot of really interesting machines. So it's worth looking at the other things. I don't know what to say about the lack of full testing though. It's kind of a neat computer. It's not one that I have, but I do see them coming up. So actually I do have a question about the 5140. So this is, what is this inside? Is this like an AT, PS2?
No, if I remember right, it was an 8088.
Okay. So how does this compare to the other one, the portable? Like the portable was an XT in a luggable case.
So the 5155 was like a compact. It's also an 8088. But this one had the LCD screen and was, you know, I'm going to look it up so that I make sure that I'm not saying wrong stuff. But as I recall it, when I had it, it was, it's an Intel 8088, 4.77 megahertz. So basically like a PC XT.
Okay. Okay. So it is essentially quite similar to the, whatever it is, the 5155. Is that right? Is that the right number?
In terms of power, I mean, this had 3.5 as opposed to 5.25 that you found in the 5155. And the 5155 was gigantic and had actual ISA slots that you could use.
Right. That's interesting because the convertible, it feels newer. Like it feels like a more recent thing than that. It's interesting that they were sort of equally powerful.
Yeah, I don't remember when the 5155 came out, but this, the convertible was from 86. So I think it is at least slightly newer.
All right. Excellent. Michael, I guess you have the next things.
Delving through my watch list, I found a couple of interesting items. The first one is if you're looking for ideas for 6 months' time for the next retro challenge, here's a book on computer peripherals that you can build by Gordon Wolfe. Now, as with all books on eBay, Earl and I will always suggest that you look for it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But this one for $29 is actually quite reasonably priced. I couldn't find it at Abbey Books when I did do my initial search. $29 for a book which doesn't seem to be overly plentiful. Doesn't seem to be too bad. It's good photos inside of some of the projects. So if you're wanting to do a little bit of interfacing, a bit of parallel input, then maybe this would be a great little book for your collection. So did you guys make any peripherals back in the day, or were you more of an off-the-shelf kind of person?
I made none. I made zero.
You made none.
The first time I used a soldering iron was as a, like, you know, whatever, 40-something-year-old.
Yeah. Okay.
I was too scared because of the price. I mean, before computers, I started out with TTL chips and breadboarding and such, but I thought if I create something and then hook it up to my computer, I'm going to blow up my computer. And there's just too much money for me back then. I didn't want to take the risk.
Oh, fair enough.
How about you?
I made a few little bits and pieces, mainly just serial connected devices. But I'm kind of with Earl, sort of like didn't really want to get too involved, was not one for doing any little solder fixes directly onto the motherboard, lest I not end up with the result of the project and also not end up with the original machine.
Right.
Paranoia goes a long way. Okay, now, this one is for Earl. So this is, my next one is a Hiragana computer keyboard for a 128K or 512K Mac.
This is really neat to look
at.
Yeah,
it's cool. Yeah.
It's in good condition, too. I will nitpick one little thing. There are two phonetic alphabets for Japanese, Hiragana and Katakana.
Hiragana, they picked the wrong one.
Yeah, they picked the wrong one. Hiragana usually is going to be more traditional Japanese words, whereas Katakana is more common with words that are borrowed from other languages. And this keyboard's displaying the Katakana alphabet as opposed to the Hiragana. But it's still cool.
Ah.
Yeah. So does it not have a... What is supposed to be on a normal keyboard between tab and shift? Like, is that where caps lock should be? They've got, that's, I think we covered this once before. That's the comma key, right?
Let me grab one. Yeah, caps lock.
I've gotten slightly better with my Japanese since the last time we talked about this. So I can now recognize at least the ka and the first syllable of that key there. But what is the second one? Na? I mean, is that kana?
Oh, yeah. Underneath the tab. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that would presumably be the thing that switches back and forth between the systems, but I'm wondering what key it's replacing.
It's caps lock on an actual keyboard, but might not necessarily be so in that mode.
Yeah. Interesting.
So,
well,
yeah, the only keyboard I could grab was actually for my plus, but same difference. Right. It's just got the numeric keypad on the right.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So I wonder if this is. I wonder what that means about the availability of caps lock on this computer. But
doesn't have it. It's an improvement.
Yeah. Well, it just calms things down.
I was going to say, how can I shout at people in my emails and my online posts? I have to keep pressing shift.
Yeah, you can just hold the shift down.
That's outrageous. I got to hold the shift key down. I'm gonna blog post about that right now.
Right. Exactly. That's cool though. Yeah, I kind of like. It's pretty nifty to see Japanese on the keyboard.
Yeah, it's not the kind of keyboard you're gonna trip over every day of the week. Well, not over here anyway.
Right. Yeah, there was a. I repeatedly kept getting close to buying a next keyboard that had the Japanese characters on it, but I didn't. I never quite hit the button, and eventually somebody beat me to it. But you know, it's not like I would use it for anything, but it's still cool looking.
Well, Paul, what have you got for me to go shopping with?
The first one is a Xerox 822 bundle. So I think there are two of them, if I remember this correctly. This is, two Xerox 820 vintage PCs with two keyboards and one dual 8-inch floppy drive. So I don't know very much at all about this computer, but I had heard of it before. It looks like it's between them, you know, you could cobble together a working system. It looks like it's kind of neat to have. One of them is kind of broken. I mean, it looks like that. Actually, it looks like the some cable has been severed. Anyway, I didn't look at this closely enough to
I think
to see.
It's a monitor cable.
Yeah, you can just tie it back together.
It's probably fixable. I don't know. If it is the monitor cable, at least there were two monitors, so you have an example to work from. And clearly something can be plugged in and works because they show one monitor screen.
That's a power. Later on, if it's the same one, it's brown, blue, green, a little bit of fiber. Yeah.
Okay, well, so then...
Just looks like a flex cord.
So that would not be... That would be relatively fixable. Mm. And they do show one monitor up that, you know, that says something V4.04 1982 Xerox Corp. So I'm kind of assuming that what didn't boot from disk, that probably just came from ROM, but... Anyway, it's kind of cool. It's $425 buy it now, which is relatively expensive. It is a local pickup, so you have to be able to get to Albion, New York. So it's quite possible that this is a very narrow audience of people that I am speaking to now. But there are two of them. So, and I don't think they're very common. I don't know very much about them, actually. So that's as far as I got. Anyone know anything about these?
Nope.
Well, they're CPM.
Are they? Mm. Okay. So the only thing that I remember finding out about these was that at one point I got a thing that had two Apple II Disk 2's in it. And it was in an enclosure that said Xerox on it. And, you know, so it was kind of like, it was some sort of dual disk device, but it had Apple disks in it. That was kind of strange. It came from the same place that I got this super low serial number Disk 2. I can't even remember what it was, but it's like in the, I mean, like, I should be able to remember. It's 435 or something like that. It's like some really, really, really low number. So I thought that this was some kind of, it may still actually be like some sort of experimental prototype dual drive setup, but it was put in this enclosure that I later discovered was basically from the Xerox 822, but for 5 1/4 inch drives. So that's why it said Xerox. And there was somebody on, I think, the Facebook Apple II enthusiasts group that said, oh yeah, I used to work with these. This was from a Xerox 822. Anyway, looks kind of interesting. If it's a CPM machine, that's also good because it means you automatically have, almost certainly have software for it if it's in, if it can read sort of normal CPM formats. So, okay, anyway, moving on to the next thing that I have. The next thing I have is a Victor 9000 computer. This one is also from the Sci-Fi Man seller. So the same seller as the, what do you call that? The IBM thing we were just talking about. Convertible.
The convertible. Uh-huh.
5145.
Yeah. So, I don't know much about Victor 9000s either, except that I think this is also a CPM machine.
Partially designed by Chuck Peddle also.
Yep. Okay.
Yep. Left Commodore to form Cirrus Systems Technology.
Yeah. Okay. So, because I'm pretty sure that in some previous episode I had also picked a Victor 9000, which had then disappeared. But this one seems working. I mean, you know, it's loaded up. Its Space War was run and works.
Yeah, apart from a couple little bumps and breaks, it looks in reasonable condition.
Yep. I don't know if it was sold as a yellow computer, but if it wasn't, it is now yellow computer.
I'll just get those blue LEDs out and...
Yeah, right. But actually, I mean, like, the thing is, it's relatively complete. I mean, like, it has the monitor, it has the keyboard, and it has the main box, two disk drives. And so if you were looking for one of these, this seems good. It's a buy it now for $400. You can make an offer. If it were to be shipped to me, it would be $150. So that's somewhat pricey, not necessarily for what it is doing, but I mean, like, it makes the base cost quite a lot. But if you were looking for one, this is one. And the next thing is, well, okay, so I don't know if this is interesting or not. I'll run through it quickly. It is a letter quality printer from General Electric. And so I think one of the things that I thought was interesting about this particularly was that it's compatible with a whole bunch of different kinds of computers. But if you want to use it with a Atari or a Commodore, it requires a little expansion pack. And what's interesting about this particular one is that it has the expansion pack. So if you were looking for a letter quality printer for your Commodore or Atari, this is it. It has the box. For some reason, it has a TV adapter as well. I don't think that's relevant, but maybe you could use it as a backup for your Atari or Commodore. You know, I'm not sure that I would be that interested to get this printer, but the fact that it has the adapter means that it's probably actually a relatively rare thing. And when it says letter quality, I think it is still... It's not a daisy wheel. It looks like it is still a ribbon printer. It's just like, I guess, you know, like a high density printhead or something. I think a number of the dot matrix printers of the time asserted letter quality by, you know, like when they really just meant, you know, it was dot matrix, but just slightly denser.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, some of the dot matrix had 24 pin.
Yeah, I don't think it's a 24 pin, though. I don't remember that being a 24 pin printer.
Oh, you had this printer? Or you...
I'm in the document game. It used to do quite a lot with printers, but
so the main thing is, if you happen to be interested in this, and it's sort of a, you know, relatively cross-platform printer, it does have this adapter if you wanted to use it for your Atari or whatever. Because I think standard Atari printers are, I think those are the ones that are guaranteed not to work anymore. Okay, I will move on to the next thing. The next thing is an Apple II clone that I never heard of, so I'll just sort of quickly point that out. It is an MT600. It is a $500 buy it now, and it is in Overland Park, Kansas, which actually is pretty close to where Kansas Fest is held. I've never seen this before. Never heard of this before. But Anyway, is this familiar to any of you who might have heard of Apple II clones?
Not for me.
No,
not to me.
There's so many of them that it's not surprising. But no, I've never heard of a MT Mac Apple II clone.
Yeah. It comes with a clone joystick that says Pride on it for some reason.
Oh, I'm so glad they have Pride.
Yeah. But anyway, it's sort of interesting if you're interested in clones. I don't know if I'm interested in clones. I think I'm not. But
I might be interested in the Franklin Ace under certain circumstances, because that, you know, that the pre-lawsuit version, right?
Mm-hmm.
You guys can check me on that, but I think there was the pre and then the post, and the, you know, the pre might be an interesting collectible, but it's probably a lot of money too.
Yeah, that one has a kind of a story to it that I think most of these sort of generic clones don't.
Yeah.
And I think they actually, I mean, like, my understanding of the Franklin was that they were pretty serious. I mean, like, they were really trying to do something serious, and not just clone Apple, but I mean, like, they engineered it fairly well. So, okay, my next one is a listing that had ended. I think, well, okay, so I'm going to leave the link in because it's interesting. So it was a really pretty elaborate Cosmac Elf setup.
Yep, I can see it there now. But yeah, it's a nice setup.
Yeah, I mean it's grungy. It's grungy because it's old, but it is, you know, it's got a lot of parts.
I like old grunge on my computers, which is why I don't retrobrite them.
Yeah.
Save the grunge.
I mean, like, you know, this is basically a pretty complete set. You know, I don't really know very much about the Cosmac Elf, and so I didn't actually realize it was so big. But it's got something like a numeric keypad with a bunch of slotted cards in it under a little plexiglass case, and a separate power supply and a keyboard and some other sort of board. Don't know what that is. It looks like it might actually be might be memory. I don't know. And it's, you know, all sort of preserved.
And hard copy. It's got hard copy. The original.
Yeah, original manuals. I don't really understand why you would put sensitive like RAM and things like that on fabric. But originally I thought it was sitting on a rug. It's sitting on a placemat on a table, but still it seemed like, I'm not sure that's the best thing. But anyway, it's pretty impressive. It was a $1,250 buy it now. So, I mean, it was not going for cheap, but I think it is probably, you know, near unique in its completeness now. And of course, in the auction name, it says, Netronics RCA 1802 Cosmac, the best you will find. So, and it might actually be true, except it's gone to somebody else now. The next thing I'll talk about is an analog to digital joystick converter. And so I don't know if this is interesting or not. I think it might be mildly interesting. It is basically, it's a little converter cable to convert between an IBM type joystick and like a Commodore / Atari type joystick, I think. Amiga is actually, I think, what it was really intended for. So this is, the auction listing says this is basically stuff that was left over when somebody sold their store to someone, and the person they sold it to didn't, you know, they didn't want the stuff. So what the seller did is seemingly take out their camera, smear Vaseline all over it, and then, like, take a photo of, like, the little things that were in the stock. So it's very hard to read any of this stuff. And if you look at the other listings, they're similarly completely out of focus. But this is a DK Products analog joystick adapter. And it's basically just a little wire. I think it actually is doing something because it's converting digital analog.
It's got to do something because, you know, you had on the IBM and the Apples this way too, that you had the potentiometer-based joysticks, whereas right. Atari, Commodore, those were just on-off, you know, digital joysticks, like the switch was either on or off.
Yeah, and now that I'm looking at this connector, I think actually I was probably incorrect in saying it was the Commodore Atari type. It may be specifically the Amiga type, because it looks like a 9-pin ending there, which is not going to...
Didn't they use the same... I thought they... 64...
Maybe they do.
I mean, it says it a little lower here. Commodore 64, 128 Amiga.
Could be. Very hard to read on the actual thing. I was really just only looking at the cable, but of course I can't quite see how that ends. It just doesn't look like the end of a normal, like Atari 2600 joystick. But anyway, it's a dollar at first bid. So if you want it, and I did find, if you search for DK analog joystick adapter, you can find a mention of it in a review in some, like in Antic or something like that, in some magazine somewhere out on the internet. I failed to save the link, but it is an actual thing that was sold and reviewed. So if you have, you know, no interest in IBMs but have a spare IBM joystick around, then I think you could use this for that. I don't know if it goes both directions, actually. It might. All right. The last thing I have is a TRS-80 color computer mint in box manuals, it says. But it's basically like what you would get if you bought a color computer new, I think. What do you think? Carrington, did you buy... You had a Coco 1, right?
I did have a Coco 1.
Does this evoke memories?
It does, yeah. In fact, this is exactly what I had.
Except yours had extra U's, right?
Mine would have had extra U's, though I don't remember that, although I would have noticed at the time if it was missing, if it had misspelled color the way this has.
Yeah.
But it's the same keyboard, the same flat, it's not really a chiclet keyboard, I don't know what this kind of keyboard is called. The flat squares that barely push in.
Yeah.
They're just, it's the worst keyboard. Well, it's not the worst keyboard, there are worse keyboards. It's just a terrible keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the thing about the Coco that you don't know from looking at it is it weighs -3 pounds. It is so much, no matter how light you think it is, it might as well just float away. You pick it up and like, this doesn't even weigh as much as this plastic would weigh. How is this? That's so light. It is crazy light. Bonkers, there's something wrong with physics light.
Excellent. But I really like the fact that is the box is in, you know, comparatively good shape, and everything, it just really looks like everything is there. It's in the styrofoam. Of course, like everything that is in styrofoam, it's also kind of embedded itself on the power cord. That I really hate that about, I don't know what it is, but like somehow styrofoam just sticks to stuff like that. But otherwise, I mean, it really does look like it's all just as you would have gotten it out of the store. So,
and it was a computer I actually really liked at the time. Mm-hmm. I liked the cartridges. I really enjoyed having a Coco back then.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it looks like actually this does not come with any cartridges. So I suppose you would need to,
like, not even a basic cart.
Yeah, so you would probably need to like provide a.
Wait, I think basic was inbuilt, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was in ROM.
So long ago. So very long ago. The other thing that's different about this than this, I think, is a like original Coco, because it doesn't have the little
badge.
Only a little sticker that will say 4K, 8K, 16K, whatever. This has none of that. So this is, I think, exactly what I had, which is like, you know, first gen. It comes as it comes. I think so. I could be wrong about that. People who know more about the Coco can write in.
-4K.
-4K. It has even less memory than you could think.
Right. It floats to the ceiling and has an OK. Usually these auctions will like take a picture of the bottom that shows you the serial number and stuff and part number and stuff. But
it's nice though. If you wanted a Coco, like it's an original Coco. It's a nice one.
Yeah, and
especially
it's,
for $50. Like, how'd it go wrong?
Oh yeah, I didn't even. Yeah, that's right. So first bid is 50, shipping from Erie, Pennsylvania. Not a seller I've come across before, but you know, that happens. So cool. All right. I guess that's it for my list, and I think we can leave it at that. So now I guess we can go to final closing notes. So Carrington, what's your first thing to add?
I'm going
to
be in Reno next weekend. Pity me.
Okay.
It's for work. It's a work conference. So Wednesday through Saturday, I'll be in Reno, Nevada. It's a conference that I have to go to every year, 18 months or so for a company. And, every year they hold it in Las Vegas, and I hate Las Vegas. It's just awful. Like, if you don't gamble and don't smoke, then like, and don't hang out with prostitutes, like, this, Las Vegas has nothing else to offer. It's so terrible. I'm always in this awful, awful convention center / resort / really it's a casino. You're fooling nobody. And it's just, I hate the thing, and I hate walking through casinos. It's just, it's not me. I dislike it every year, and every year I complain about it, thinking this is the worst ever. And then this year they said, we're not going to be in Las Vegas. Oh no, we're going to Reno. You thought it couldn't get worse. Let's go to Reno. So I'm going to be in a casino thing in Reno for for it. It's just hell to me. So that's Wednesday through Saturday. How awful.
Sorry.
Ooh, got that coming up.
Almost going to be, yeah, I mean, you're going to be really close to Portland. Maybe hell. Closer than you normally get.
The airport in Reno. I've been to Reno once, and the airport actually says, "Welcome to Reno. Abandon all hope. You enter here." It's just bad as it gets. It's just going to be terrible. Sorry for listeners who live in Reno. I mean, I'm sorry for listeners who live in Reno. I mean that literally. It's so bad. So I'm going to be there. The only good thing is I'm super behind on playing the latest game for Eaten by a Grue. Mm-hmm. So I'm basically going to just lock myself in my hotel room and play an Infocom game for 3 days. It's basically what I'm going to do. I have to be there, but they can't make me participate.
Yeah.
So I got that going on.
I have a memory from a long time ago of, I forget exactly when this was, but I flying into the Reno airport. And what I remember is that, like, and this may no longer be true, of course, because this was probably quite a long time ago, but, you know, like, you basically, right in the airport, there's, like, a little enclosed glass room where, like, you can gamble and smoke.
Oh, it's the same thing with Las Vegas. Las Vegas, you'll be, like, at gate 7 waiting for your plane. You look to the left and there are 3 slot machines. There's just like slot machines everywhere. Yeah. And it's basically the same thing for any place in Nevada, I think. What is wrong with you, Nevada?
All right. Earl, where have you gotten in your projects?
So Retro Challenge. Man, I had a lot of stuff happen over the last couple of weeks. I hate it when this happens during Retro Challenge, but the bottom line is I had a goal to get a 6502 or a Z80 core running on an FPGA and actually just run a program. And I did it. I got that part done, which was cool. I didn't write the core. I mean, I took one of the freely available ones that's out there, and every FPGA board is different, and you got to futz around with it. And I got it to run on mine, so that was awesome. But I'd like to, I got a few hours left here in September, so I want to try and do the stretch goal where I actually use some sort of input to get some sort of output. I'm just going to do it with switches. So, like, you read the state of the switches, and then 6502 runs a little program, and then, put something out on the LED lights. If I can get that done, then I'm going to call it good. So, wish me luck.
Oh, good luck for the rest of your afternoon, I guess.
Exactly.
Michael, you have any closing thoughts?
Well, it's too late for me for Retro Challenge, seeing it's already
October.
Yeah. So, no, I didn't do anything. Now, haven't been doing much retro at all. As I said, getting ready for Hazard Reduction Burn here. But going through our property down the back, we did actually find a rare plant on our property. So, as I said, not retro, but very... very exciting to have found a Melaleuca deanii on our property. So,
excellent.
Cool.
So, you've got rare, and then above rare is endangered. So this one is rarer than rare.
I assume that they're not burning it.
No, we've actually, that was part of, we were negotiating the line with the local captain of the rural fire service here. Mm-hmm. And so that's away from there, but not retro, but it's just something else. You just don't know what you go. I wish it was something a little bit more exciting and colorful with pretty flowers and whatnot. It's just another scraggly Australian native bush. So
still, it's cool though.
It's rugged country out there, man.
It is. Oh, and I did pick up a Apple II clone, but I haven't seen it yet. So it was going up for grabs in Brisbane, so I got my brother to pick it up, and then I've got to go up there sometime to collect it. So no idea what I've got, but it's 2 boxes and a large suitcase worth of Apple II clone. Cool. And discs, drives, and manuals, and books and stuff. So it'll be like Christmas.
No, that's fun. So you don't know what clone it is?
It's an MT Mac, I think.
No, it wasn't clear in there, but my brother picked it up and he said, yeah, it looks like an Apple II computer to me.
Well, best of luck. I hope it is something interesting.
Oh, I hope it works. So, what have you been up to, Paul?
So what I've been up to is basically like receiving the post. I guess. But I have a couple of things that I'd been kind of, you know, hoping to get have arrived. So I kind of just out of the blue managed to get myself Osborne Vixen, which is the OCC-4. These are really super hard to find, but there was someone who was selling it. Basically, the drives were missing, but otherwise, I forget even how much it was. I probably should remember, but it was way less than they usually are sold for. And, you know, it didn't have the drives, but it does, you know, I got it, and I think it's missing a key, and there's a little bit of a crack in it. But, I mean, it starts. I mean, like, I plugged it in and got to the boot screen and stuff, and so, and I think the drives are relatively standard thing, so I think I'll be able to put it back together. And I'm kind of looking forward to playing with that, just because that was the end of that was like the last in the Osborne line, the most refined, really kind of cool looking model. It's small, it has a fairly big screen. It has an interesting sort of like angled screen keyboard thing. So it I don't know. Anyway, it's I'm pleased that I have that. I'll play around a bit with that. I got a couple of TI-95s, which are. I think we talked a little bit about the TI-CC40, which was a really terrible computer.
Mm-hmm.
I
can't do anything with it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. It's like it has no way to access the outside world. Basically, you can't save anything to tape. You can't do anything with it. There were some peripherals that were made for it, but those are hard to get.
The HexBus peripherals,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and so the TI-95 is actually sort of a calculator form factor, but it's essentially the same machine. But that has a few other peripherals made for it. So I've gotten a couple of those. They're relatively cheap, and I'm kind of hoping that I can kind of connect these together now. So it'd be an interesting project to do. I also wound up with a Cricket, which is a Mockingboard for the... Is Mockingboard? No, an Echo.
The Cricket, I thought, was Echo. I'm more interested in Cricket as in the game.
Yes, right. So the Cricket is a sort of special Echo 2 speech synthesizer for the Apple IIc. And here, this is the most exciting thing. I now probably have the entire BPI accounting system for the Apple III. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think.
It's actually a little bit of a weird thing because the Apple III, this is really long closing notes, I apologize. I'm mostly done. But Apple distributed BPI General Accounting in, you know, sort of Apple packaging for the Apple III, and it's pretty common. I mean, like, you know, not everybody who had an Apple III had one, but lots of people did. So it's, you know, relatively easy to find the BPI General Accounting module. And of course, this is not interesting, but you know, you can get it. It was interesting at the time. But then it turns out that there are actually a couple of other modules that I didn't know about until fairly recently. So I wound up getting the payroll module and accounts receivable. And the one I just got that I think completes the set is accounts payable. So I'm not going to use any of these for anything. I will scan them and that'll be that. But it was interesting that they even exist, you know, like that there were things that I'd never even heard of that I now have that were Apple distributed. I mean, that's the weirdest part, is they're in Apple packaging and I didn't know they existed. I also got an Epson HX20 that had a speech synthesizer with it. And it turned out, so somebody had pointed this out to me on Twitter. I forget now who it was. I think it might have been Ian.
Those are pretty rare, I think.
Yeah. Well, so I have an HX20, but the speech synthesizer was the thing that was interesting. And actually, there were manuals too. There were manuals for it and the CX20 modem and a couple of other things. And so I didn't have the manuals. I had the modem, but not the manuals, and for these other things. So I thought, all right, well, I'll go ahead and get this. It was a nice set, but it turned out that it was from somebody who's in Massachusetts, and so he thought he would just bring it over rather than having it shipped, which is cool. The reason he was going to bring it over is because he was going to be in Boston anyway, and it turned out that where he was specifically going was, like, he had an appointment at a place that's, as it turns out, is, like, right next door to my office. So, he sent me this thing saying, I'm going to be at this address, and, you know, like, can I get to, you know, is it possible to get to you from there? I'm like, yeah, it's, like, about a 37-second walk. So that was kind of neat. So actually, like his wife had the appointment and he was at a loose end while that was happening. So he came over and we talked some, interesting retro stuff while that was happening. So I got the HX20 and interesting conversation with Carlos. So that was cool.
Nice.
And yeah, there's other stuff, but I think maybe I should stop. One thing though I will say is that I just got finished recording what turned out to be the first half of Floppy Days recording about the Apple III with Randy Kindig. So I will continue that later. But my guilt level about the long, now it's over a year since the last episode of Drop 3 Inches is increasing. So maybe there'll be another one of those too soon. Anyway, that's it. Talk. I can't stop talking. That's why there's going to be two episodes of Floppy Days, because I can't stop talking. But okay, anything else anyone wants to say before I actually land this?
No, land away.
Please land, everybody says. All right, so that's it for this show. You can find show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. That link will now work in the show notes. That didn't before. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and you can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast. And we are a member of the Throwback Network. That's at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And so, until next time...
Retro Compute!